and the signal strength will change by 20 decibels, 100 to 1 power ratio. Because of the way all those individual paths add up in a co-phase manner or an anti-phase manner. The next thing I did in that environment was to emit extremely brief pulses, 1 nanosecond pulses, which means that the pulse coming out of the transmitting antenna at the speed of light was 1 foot long. So therefore, I was probing the environment 1 foot at a time and looking at all those echoes on a sampling oscilloscope. Fascinating thing to look at. You'd be amazed how complicated the environment really is in a simple office space of an ordinary commercial building. If you've got any further, by the way, congratulations that NASA is using your program. Is this a effort being done, funded by your place of business, John, or are you doing this out of a labor of love and people are discovering the value of what you've done? Hopefully you've got a user-friendly program. Many of the programs that do what you describe are pretty hostile programs where a person has to go to a course for a couple of days just to learn how to load the data into the program. KD2BD, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW on the TechNet from KD2BD. It's a labor of love. It's free software. It runs under the Linux operating system, and it's partially, I'd say it's somewhat user-friendly. It's just picky about its friends, I guess. The problem is that the STS-99 topography data is very nice. It's very crisp and clear. However, since it was taken on a slant range from the space shuttle, there are shadows and other wells in the data that are just voids, and they need to be filled in somehow. So I either try to do an adjacent pixel average to fill in those areas, or I merge those missing areas with older U.S. Geological Survey data. For example, the CS99 topography data will show Central Park in New York to be at sea level because there's lots of buildings surrounding it. And so when I merge the two data sets together, you know, it fills in that void. By the way, I also saw that same effect on the space shuttle engines just using my naked eye. I saw the engine was on. I heard that they were waiting for main engine cutoff. I heard they announced main engine cutoff, and still I was seeing the shuttle engines. And I was trying to rationalize what was going on because I was receiving a shuttle audio via a local ATV repeater in Lincroft, New Jersey. Currently transmitting shuttle video and audio at 439.25 megahertz. And I'm just picking that up using a Pantsat receiver. And I'm pretty sure the MPEG encoding produces a little bit of a delay. So I realized I was hearing the delay, the audio through a delay. And it just seemed like it made the situation even more odd because of that. As far as multipath, I've seen situations where I tried to finagle antennas and not the best of locations, for example, in attic environments and things like that. And in some cases I found that small Yagis work well. In other cases they do a horrible job. And for quite a bit of time it took me a while to try to figure out why this was happening. And the conclusion I came to was if I probed the attic area and the region where I was going to have the antenna installed, the whole effective capture area of that antenna, with a portable receiver, I would find many peaks and valleys in that area. And so my conclusion was that the antenna itself, the Yagi, at placed in that position, each element would not be subject to the same field strength. They would be seeing different levels of field strength, signals arriving at different angles, in phase, out of phase. And so in situations like that, I found a simple unity gain antenna opposite the sweet spot actually perform better than a Yagi in those situations. So I know some people try to make up for being in a bad location by having a gain antenna, a high gain antenna. It doesn't always work out to their expectations. K2RAW on a TechNet from KD2BD.
Boy, I ran into that situation big time, John, out at Edwards Air Force Base. Edwards Air Force Base, when I was there in 1989, when they just turned on the Benny field anechoic facility, arguably the world's largest indoor antenna range. It was roughly 1.5 acres of floor space inside of a shielded room that is 7 stories high, 70 feet tall. And you could put a full-size B-1B bomber in the middle of that room on the turntable, rotate it, and make all kinds of measurements. Really big room. And they needed a place to mount a bunch of antennas to send signals into the aircraft. And so they built these 4x4 wooden stands that were about 15 feet tall with wooden pegs all glued together to hold the antennas in 3 different areas of the room, the so-called set sites. And it took me a long time to convince people that at X-band, a 4x4 piece of wood will give you an echo that's a couple of dB weaker than a chunk of steel of the same size. That wood has got a dielectric constant of 3. That signal has been propagating through air with a dielectric constant of 1. When it hits the wood, a significant percentage of that X-band signal will reflect off that wood. It took me a long time to convince them that going to cover up the wood with anechoic absorbing material, even though it's wood and it's non-conductive and they thought it would have no effect. By the same token, the attic of your and my house has got these great big 2x8 rafters. It's got the 1 or 2 layers of plywood. It's got the tar paper. It's got shingles. It's got nails. It's got probably aluminum backing on the backs of insulation that are in the ceiling. It's got wiring that goes, the BX or Romex wiring. What I'm getting at is your attic is an extremely complicated environment as far as the RF is concerned. Optimistically, we want to believe that all that wood is transparent, all those nails are too small to not do anything, all of that Romex BX wiring is transparent, none of it's a resonant length at any of those frequencies or polarizations of interest. The aluminum backing on all of the fiberglass insulation, we want to believe it's not there. Well, obviously, any antenna you put inside of an attic, I don't care if it's a satellite antenna at microwave frequencies, or if it's an HF antenna at HF frequencies, or a 2-meter antenna, it's not going to behave the same or as well. On top of that, with any good-sized Yagi, some of the tips of those elements are going to be near some of those 2x8 rafters, adding capacitance to the ends of those rafters and tuning them, adding capacitance to the ends of the elements of the Yagi and tuning them to another frequency. So, in general, you're not going to get the same performance. A really smart guy could probably map out his old attic very carefully, figure out where the capacitance concentrations are of wood, metal, and other things, and possibly readjust the element lengths accordingly of the Yagi and get back some of that performance, but not all of it, and still be able to rotate the Yagi in the attic. Unless you've got a very large attic, it's not so likely. It's very tempting to take your television aerial, your satellite aerial, your ham radio antenna, and put them in the attic to protect them from the weather so that the antenna lasts for 20 years. Very tempting. You really study what happens to the RF energy that tries to get through that roof into that attic. And you'll soon discover that you're way ahead of the game to mount the antenna on the chimney and accept the fact that the weather is going to do terrible things to the antenna and you're going to replace the antenna every 10 years. That's just the price of doing business if you want to do serious state-of-the-art ham radio. Be willing to replace the stuff that's out in the weather, or buy stuff that's very well constructed out of stainless steel and so on. So, an awful lot of these, every time I tell people about the fact that a 2x4 will give you an echo that's only a couple of dB weaker than a chunk of steel of the same size, they look at me very strangely saying that, where did you come from? What in the world gives you that opinion? To which my philosophy is, what in the world made you think that's going to act like air? It's a hell of a lot more dense than air, and that signal, when it hits more dense material, is going to be affected. I mean, that's the whole philosophy of a magnifying glass. A magnifying glass has got a refractive index of 2 or 3, and it bends the light going through it. It's got a dielectric constant 2 or 3 times higher than the air around it. That's how the magnifying glass focuses that signal. By the same token, you've got a very poor set of magnifying glasses, so to speak, out of every one of those 2x8 rafters in the roof of your house. They're all doing crazy kinds of focusing of the signal. Okay, let's see. I don't know who else we've got who said yes. Was it WB2COK? I think he said no. Who else gave me a yes that has a question or a comment? Give me a call, letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, I think there's nobody there. Mel, what's been going on with you? Did you get a chance? You live in a beautiful seaside community where you could go out there and watch the shuttle last night at around 8:50 or so, 8:55. You could watch it come up over your southern horizon over the water, watch it for a minute and a half, and go over your eastern horizon, and you would have seen a very interesting event last night, Mel. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, sort of a little bit of it, Dick. It is the street lighting. That really takes out some of it. I was going to get down to the beach originally, but my ex-wife got a little nervous. She said, you're going to be crazy to get down to the beach now in the dark and everything like that. You know, so I didn't really do anything other than stand out on the patio deck.
And that's one way to get around the problem, is just to move up to one side. I would have been tempted to go down to the beachfront because I don't think you live in a very dangerous area, as I see it. The nice thing about being right over the water, you would get a real good view, particularly if you've got your binoculars mounted on a tripod. I was tempted to bring out my telescope, and then I did a quick calculation of how fast they move, and I realized keeping a telescope aimed at them would have been very difficult. Binoculars are the right way to do it. And you do get a lot more resolution out of binoculars when they're mounted on a tripod and then you manually move them. So I think you were listening to the audio just like I was, and you saw the same thing, that even though the audio we're hearing is delayed, still from the time the astronauts declared that main engine cutoff had taken place, I was seeing the bright flame coming out of the main engines of the shuttle for a number of seconds afterwards until it did a couple of pops, so to speak, and then it became a much dimmer flame, which I think was due to the orbital maneuvering system. According to my space shuttle operator's manual, there's supposed to be a 1:40 in between before they turn on the orbital maneuvering system, but that's the old philosophy when the book was printed 10 years ago. For all I know, they turn on the orbital maneuvering system essentially immediately these days. I'm having trouble believing that the nozzles of the jet engines were glowing that much, because they've got this they have the fuel flowing through them continuously in order to cool them. So I don't think they glow. I did not. And I'm having trouble believing there were running lights on the shuttle where it flies. The last thing it's got to worry about is encountering another aircraft. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger, but I said I saw the glow continuous. I said I thought it was afterglow. I said, gee, I hope it's just afterglow. I thought maybe they had some kind of problem already, because supposedly main engine shutoff had already taken, already had been announced. So I saw that funny glow. I said to myself, what the heck is that? And I figured the don't tell me they've run into some problem already. But is it possible that afterglow is just because of something in the atmosphere, that we really weren't seeing the same things they were down in Florida, Dick? Over.
I doubt it very highly. They did that burnout of the main engine at something like 120 nautical miles. They're way above the atmosphere. So that doesn't explain it. Also, when they turn off the engine, I know that they turn off the oxygen first and the hydrogen second. They don't want pure oxygen hitting the metal of a hot engine, because it does embrittlement and things like that. So the pure hydrogen pouring through the engine after the main engine cutoff, would it still give you a glow like that? Well, what the engine really is, it's a very complicated turbo pump. It literally burns some of the fuel to generate the power to force the fuel at a high pressure into the actual nozzle of the engine itself. So from the time they cut off the fuel to the turbo pump, my guess is there's quite a bit of fuel left to do quite a bit more thrusting and burning afterwards. That's my guess as to what's going on. But it never completely winked out to me. Until they went over the horizon, I saw them continuously. So I think the new philosophy is to turn on the orbital maneuvering system a lot sooner without that delay that they used to have. I'm going to do a little bit more checking in that and see if anyone has any information on that one. So back to you, Mel, KQLIW.
Roger. Yeah, I'm sure I would have had a much better view down from the beach, but I guess there was even an attempt going down there. Really, actually, I think it's illegal. They've been trying to prevent different criminal activities in a number of parts of this section of Lisbon, and usually it's prohibited to go on the beach after dark because they haven't actually posted there. Beach closed after dark. But I know a way I can get on the beach, of course. I know where, exactly which way to go. I can go right down and cut across. But I think it, I better not do anything because, I'll get the routine. You get arrested or something. I think it's better off just let it go, Dick. But it would have been excellent, yes, with the binocular on some kind of support. Down right on the water, it would have been, I'm sure, a very good view, especially very dark down there at the water edge. But again, like I say, I just had to, as they say, mitigate circumstances. Go ahead.
Makes sense. And even if the gendarmes came along and you're out there with your binoculars at a very specific time when the technical world all knows that the space shuttle flight 116 was going off, you'd have no trouble confirming what you're doing. And I can't believe you would have gotten in any trouble, even if you got arrested, so to speak. So, with hindsight, I would have, in your situation, as long as I thought life and limb was not at risk from marauding illegal guys down there, other than that, I would have been tempted to go down the beach because it was a fun thing to watch. And because there will be future flights to do more installation of hardware on the space shuttle, there's a reasonably good chance this is going to happen again. A nighttime launch at certain times of the year is very desirable as far as having a convenient way to meet up with the shuttle. They have to launch within about a 1 or 2 minute period at just the right angle so that the space shuttle orbit has a plane of orbit that is equal to the plane of the International Space Station. You want to make sure they come out at the right angle of plane because to shift the plane of orbit is the most inefficient maneuver. You don't want to do that one. You also want to launch at the right time so that the shuttle, the space station, is ahead of you. And because you're in a lower orbit at first, you're actually moving faster in miles per hour. And within a day and a half, you catch up with it. They're going to have a rendezvous on Monday. And so the so-called, and to catch up is not common sense. I mean, if you ended up in orbit, the identical orbit as the International Space Station, and you are 1 mile behind them. Common sense would say, okay, I blast the rocket in the direction where I go a little bit faster, and I'll catch up with them. Because you blasted the rocket in the direction to speed up, at first you would see the distance between them and you decrease. Then you would suddenly sense the fact that your higher velocity is putting you in a higher orbit. You would move up above them, you would then slow down and fall behind them even further than where you started. So believe it or not, to catch up with them when they're ahead of you, you blast the rocket in their direction in order to do what you think is a slowdown. That puts you into a lower orbit. You speed up and go under them and ahead of them, then reverse the procedure and come back up and hit them from the bottom, so to speak. Very opposite of common sense. The first time the astronauts put up a pair of Gemini. They put up a pair of Gemini satellites, and the astronauts try to link up with each other, and they ended up burning up all the reaction control fuel and not linking, because they tried doing the common sense thing that I just described, and they suddenly realized they were doing a push away instead of a get closer. So, how has your mail been running this week, and what would you like to talk about tonight, Professor? K2KEY, K2LIW in the tech band.
Yeah, very good. This is K2KEY. I know space travel is a lot more complicated than we've grown up with the science fiction, the Flash Gordon and all that kind of Buck Rogers type stuff. And it's a lot more to it than they surmised back in those days. You laugh at it now, but in those days it was science, of the future. We've grown up. As far as, going on the beach, years ago, when Halley's Comet was, making a sudden pass, basically, they had to be really down in the south part of the world to see Halley's Comet. We tried to see it down here at the beach, and I took the telescope down there and the kids down there, and believe it or not, we got all of a sudden, a helicopter came over with a spotlight from the helicopter shining on us, and then the police came in. The daughters, they tried to explain to the police what we were doing trying to see Halley's Comet, but we were told very politely that, I guess the only reason I didn't get arrested because of the kids, but the beach was closed after dark, but that's the only way we got a glimpse at Halley's Comet, Dick, over.
Good thing to watch. Yeah, each time we have one of these major astronomical events, Halley's Comet or Shoemaker-Levy 9 and so on, the sales for telescopes go up real fast. And each of the stores selling telescopes will advertise, oh, this telescope has got a gain of 2,000, 200, 300, 400, crazy numbers. A smarter person will realize that whenever you set the gain of a telescope higher than 60 times the number of inches of the forward aperture, you're wasting your time. In other words, if your telescope is 3 inches in diameter, the forward piece of glass, as a refractor, or as a reflector, it doesn't matter. If the telescope has an active diameter of 3 inches, 3 times 60 is 180, you go to 180 or above, and you're going to get a picture that's a pure blur. It's useless. Yeah, technically it is a magnification of 200 or 300, but you can't use it. So everybody thinks when you buy a telescope, you want to buy the one with the biggest gain number. Not true at all. There's a lot of other criteria. And when you go to Sky and Telescope magazine, all you have to do is go to Google and do a search on Sky and Telescope. And when you get to the website of Sky and Telescope, they have a very nice section that helps you as a beginner select binoculars or telescope and to do it with the right selection criteria. You don't have to spend a lot of money, but you can end up wasting a lot of money buying something that's going to be fairly useless if you don't read that article first. That's my suggestion. So astronomy is something that confuses an awful lot of people. One of my very simple physics puzzles that I'll ask people is, what causes summer and winter? Well, the average person will say, well, we're closer to the sun in the summertime. Absolutely not true. The Earth is closest to the sun on January 3rd, in the middle of our winter. So it's not closely. Yeah, the tilt of the Earth is a factor. But the people who say that, well, we're closer, and then you say, gee, when we're in winter, the people in the southern hemisphere are in summer. It's a national pastime in Australia for the majority of people who are healthy to go swimming on Christmas Day. It's the height of their summer. Back to you, Mel. KQRIW.
Call the frequency.
Something.
This is Kilo Charlie 2, Alpha Charlie Romeo.
Better suntan in the winter time than you will in the summer.
Anybody copy out there?
Somebody wants to make a comment, I believe. Go ahead.
This is KC2, ACR in New York. Do you have an emergency, sir?
No, I just want to say hello and ask you where you're from, you know, what your location is.
Okay. This is the middle of the technical net that meets at this time on the 146.85 frequency for the last 22 years. You're allowed to join us, sir, if you want to. Give us your name and whether or not you have a question or a comment on the subject that's on the floor. KC2, ACR, what's your name? KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Well, my name is Lyle. I'm sorry, I didn't realize that. I just turned the thing on and I heard talking. I just want to know where you're from. You're coming in very well here. We're located here in Westchester County, New York. I'm sorry if I cut it. This is KC2 with ACR clear.
Very fine, Len. Yeah, we're here, as I said, every Sunday night starting at 8 o'clock for the last 22 or 23 years. I think we started in 1982, going on 24 years. And so we discuss things about ham radio and things related to ham radio. Astronomy is sort of related to it. That's why we're discussing astronomy now. So back to you, Mel. But I wonder, how big is your telescope? Is yours bigger than mine? There's a pun there somewhere. KQKUY, KQRIW on the tech map.
Hey, what I see.
Okay, no, it's just a simple telescope. I don't remember who's making this to a Lux, something Lux. Somebody gave it to me many years ago. They had given it to their kids, and they bounced it around and everything. Part of the tripod was broken, and I managed to just, you know, to patch it up. And for what we use it for, it's great. It's got that 100 power scope or whatever it is. But, you know, it's for what we were doing with it with kids and everything, get them interested in. And it's, like I say, not, you know, a high-quality piece of equipment. The one person down there, I remember, one gentleman down there brought a very interesting telescope. It was a company called, a very compact thing. Gee, it was on a little stand. It was called a Cristar, and it had an automatic tracking device on it that kept it, you could set it up to mechanical device. So he had a hand unit. I think he programmed it through his hand unit, or can control it by the motor, by pushing buttons. But I was amazed at what possibility you could have of the amount of power and all. I don't know exactly how powerful it was, but it seemed to be a pretty good piece of equipment and very compact. Dick, I wonder if you've ever heard of it, the Cristar, over.
Hey, what up, Dick? Go ahead, Fred. You want to join us?
Yeah, I just had a comment, but I'll let you do answer his question.
Why don't you give us your comment first, Fred? I haven't heard from you in a long time.
Yeah, normally I've done other things, but I haven't had a chance to listen to the net. Although, I want to tell you something, Dick. A few years ago, somebody had a suggestion for doing something, repairing buttons on a keypad using the stuff from that you use to fix the your rear window defroster, and I had occasion to use it, and it was absolutely fabulous. I had a keyboard which was non-replaceable. It was on a machine at work, and it made the machine like it was brand new. But my comment was that I know you used the term Haley's comment, which is actually correct, although usually curious will jump up and down and say that you're supposed to say Halley's Comet. And the fact is that the probable pronunciation was Halley. There are three correct pronunciations in England. Any one is correct. All is known is that Halley was what Queen Anne used, and nobody knows what the, for sure, how the Mr. Haley or Halley or Halley pronounced his name. That was my comment. Thank you, Dick.
Very well. Yes. I am familiar with the fact that everybody tends to call it Halley's Comet.
The astronomers will call it Halley's Comet. The family, I was told, pronounces the name Holy. And so, one of those unusual names. And, Mel, the beautiful telescope you're talking about, you called it Questar. Most people call it Questar. And Questar was on page number 2 or page number 3 of Sky and Telescope magazine with a one-page, full-page ad for, gee, it seemed like a decade at least they were running those ads. A very popular Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope. In other words, it's got a parabolic-like mirror, which is really spherical. The main mirror with a hole in the center. It's got a sub-reflecting mirror out in front, which is essentially a hyperbolic, and although it's also got a correcting lens. I own a Schmidt-Cassegrain 8-inch diameter. I think the Questar, I believe the normal Questar is around 3 inches or 3.5 inches. A beautiful desktop mounting structure. I think it also had a motor mechanism that would allow it to scan in azimuth with a polar mount and track the Earth's curve, the Earth's rotation. Beautiful piece of instrumentation. I think they were, in their day, close to $1,000. A little bit on the pricey side, but very, very well constructed. You'll also notice on the Questar, the outer tube has got this rotatable metal shell to it, which has got the whole sky map on it. So it helps you locate certain certain things you're looking for. I'm always amazed when I run into the really serious astronomer-type people that I occasionally will meet at the ASLI group, Astronomical Society of Long Island. You can take a camera some day of the year in some crazy direction, set it up on your tripod, open the lens for 20 seconds and take a time exposure of some tiny little chunk of sky, and you show it to a guy who's really serious about astronomy, and he'll say, yeah, I recognize that. That's right alongside of the Gemini constellation, and that's a so-and-so star. I'm always amazed. On top of that, all you and I have got to do is go to a place that's really dark, like Cherry Hill Park in Pennsylvania, which is declared by official decree of Pennsylvania an official dark zone. And so a good set of eyes there can see a magnitude 7 star. And when you get to a really dark place, and wait till your eyes are dark adapted, you will see the Milky Way in a way that'll just amaze the hell out of you. You'll think there's a cloud passing across the sky in front of you, except the cloud doesn't move. It's all those stars of the Milky Way. And so the whole sky gets so filled up with stars that your normal way of recognizing things in a metro area essentially disappears. You lose all points of reference because there's so darn many stars in between that you've never seen before. And so there are lots of people worried about the fact that our modern urban style is starting to do things to make the sky disappear. We all make sure that every one of our buildings that are a commercial building or a building for the town, you know, your municipal buildings are very well lit up at nighttime because we believe it stops the burglaries and things like that. We don't carefully choose the lighting fixtures on our highways. They aim an awful lot of light upward, which not only creates glare in the eyes of the drivers, but also lights up the local sky. We also have great big parking lots and shopping centers that have all kinds of bright lights. So the flare light from the sky, because of moisture, aerosols, and whatever in the sky, dust and things like this, means that the sky is nowhere near as dark as it used to be. And therefore, modern-day people are losing all sight of what used to be our respect of the sky and what astronomy really was. Back to you, Mel. You were starting to tell us whether or not you've gotten some mail this year. Here we go. Mail this week. And I wonder if you have another one of your continuing lectures on the subject of the Smith chart. K2KEY, better known as Professor Mel, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay. Very good, Dick. Yes, I know astronomy is a fascinating subject, and I've only delved into it very, very slightly. Basically, it's hard, like you say, to really get a good view of the sky from Brooklyn area here, except down at the beach. And just when it's good to get down there, the time that, of course, would be ideal to go down there, like I say, you could have problems. So it's very occasional that you can, you know, maybe find out if they're going to have some kind of special event. Maybe you can make some kind of special arrangement with the police department or whatever, but not easy to get permits like that, Dick. Very, very hard. Anyway, yeah, I was going to say that I got a number of emails, and a lot of them very positive. Somebody did, we mentioned last week, we talked about new metal shields, and they said that was very common. This gentleman was involved with audio recordings way back when they did reel-to-reel recordings, and he said all the commercial reel-to-reel recording equipment used on underneath the head cover, the play or record head basically had a new metal shield around it to protect it from, I guess, magnetism outside, you know, extraneous magnetism, to keep the head from becoming magnetized, even though he said every time they went to make a recording at the studio, first everything would be magnetized, especially the head. So, new metal was around, and yes, I did look it up. The new metal was used as the shield in the television sets of the 60s. They used a new metal shield around the picture tube, that shield that snapped on around the tube, and it was held there by, it looked like big hose clamps. So that's just some comments I got about new metal, Dick, before I go ahead with the Smith chart over.
Hey, that doesn't surprise me, Mel, because the very early sets seem to have an extremely delicate convergence alignment required so that the red, green, and blue dots would all come to the exact same position on the phosphor so that you got a clear picture and all the three colors lined up correctly. The early sets were very sensitive to stray magnetic fields. Doesn't surprise me at all that metal around the picture tube probably served a dual purpose. One, to protect you, the consumer, just in case the glass ever imploded. And second of all, to protect it from stray magnetic fields. Your modern-day Sony-type Trinitron tube, where the deflection takes place very close to the phosphor nowadays, is nowhere near as sensitive. In the old days, I remember people saying that if you were a critical watcher of color television, and if you had the set in the north side of your living room, and someone did a convergence alignment, and you decided to rearrange the furniture, and you put the set in the southern side of the living room, in theory, the convergence would deviate quite a bit to a discriminating watcher, and a realignment procedure in the old days would be required. K2KUY, K2LIW in the tech deck.
K2J.
Let's see what Eric's going to say about that. Eric, give us some more words on that one.
Alright, the first RCA color TV set, it had a tube in it, a 21AXP22. It had a metal jacket, okay. Actually, it was a metal jacket over the glass bulb. And it was round, didn't have the rectangular 4x3 shape. That was actually a nickel metal alloy to reduce the magnetic field. And that was a 45 degree deflection, which means you didn't need a heck of a lot of power to drive the yoke. As far as like moving your set, and what happens is you'd get a purity splotch. The actual red, green, and blue would disconverge from each other, but the beam landing would change, which would make a usually reddish kind of splotch or splash across the screen. And even in those days, they had the gouging coils around the tube, so you had to just turn the set on and off a few times, or if you happened to be someone with a degaussing coil, you just whack it with a degaussing coil, and wherever it is that you had it positioned, just keep it there, and that's the way you go. Why some of the older television trucks had new metal walls, very thin sheets, they were like 16ths of an inch thick, didn't take much. The reason for that was, in the old days of image opticon, very, very sensitive to magnetic field. I'll give you an example. At Crystal Palace in, at the BBC in London, they actually, on the studio floor, had a compass which way was pointing north. And basically, what they did was they lined the cameras up pointing north, did the geometry adjustments on the tube, and then they would move the cameras into position for being used for the shoot. And this is in the early 60s. They were actually 5280s. Beautiful tubes, if you've ever seen one. 3.5-inch IOs. Very sensitive to magnetic fields. They also had a dynode assembly, which looks like a photomultiplier down at the back. So that type of tube, you shot an electron at the target, which had the image focused on it. And the electrons that would actually be given off, that would be part of the video signal, where there was light exposing the target surface, would travel to the back of the tube through this grid assembly and get amplified. K2R, WKA2 again.
Interesting. Were there three separate image opticon tubes with a dichroic mirror in front of it in order to get color transmission?
Yeah, that's correct. And let's see, in the TK-42s, which was actually three IOs, and the next generation camera was three Rincons and one IO. RCA at that time, they didn't use prisms, per se. There was a prism block, which would actually split the light up in three directions, but not deal with color. And actually, in the first ones, they really didn't use dichroics. What they used was filters. There was a series of first surface mirrors to get the image to the tube, but the color separation was actually a big Raton 40 filter, one being red, one being green, one being blue, with the spectral responses tuned specifically to where the phosphors of the picture tube are.
Wow. A modern-day camera, I presume it's all done with charge-coupled devices, and I'm guessing now that you've got an array, and each individual pixel has side-by-side a red, green, and a blue-sensitive charge-coupled device. Is that what the mosaic on a modern CCD camera is like?
Well, unfortunately, sensitivity and light sensitivity of CCDs, their spectral responses, it's fairly broad, but they tend to like to want to see red and infrared. That's where they're most sensitive. So it just so happens that our soon-to-be-defunct transmission system of color television, which is NTSC, or never twice the same color, as many people like to call it, actually, the way we matrix red, green, and blue, because we don't transmit red, green, and blue over the air. The method of transmission, it's AM actually, and we have another little subcarrier, which actually we have two subcarriers, which are exactly at 358 and they're 90 degrees out of phase with one another, which is another sort of phase modulation scheme, but it's also amplitude sensitive. Because where the CCD is the least sensitive is blue, it just so happens we only use 11% of the blue light to make the color picture, so where there's blue light, the CCDs generate more noise than they generate the image, so to speak. I mean, it's not that bad. The spectral response to the new hyperhead stuff is pretty good, but it's still kind of lacking up in the blue area, so they actually run those chips with a bit more gain, K2R, WK2J.
A modern broadcast quality camera, color camera, NTSC type, roughly how big in volume and roughly how many pounds and roughly how many dollars? Because all of your NTSC cameras are about to disappear, or there's another question, are you going to continue using the current cameras, or when you go over to purely digital television in a few years, will everybody be buying a brand new set of cameras? Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, Roger, Dick. Actually, if you bought your camera within the last 5 years, you're not going to do anything with it because usually it'll play 16x9, which will eventually become the standard in digital television, even for low res or low definition or standard definition, we call it. Most of the cameras in the last 5 to 7 years will switch over to 9, which gives you that widescreen aspect ratio, but it'll still be 525 line. So whether you're going to switch over to high definition or not, you're covered, so to speak. As far as broadcast cameras go, let's go back to the days of the first RCA camera, which say TK-41, 42. The camera had weighed about 375 pounds, plus the lens, which was another 100 and something pounds, plus the weight to balance the whole thing, plus the three racks of tubes, the 3 6-foot racks full of tubes to make the thing go. It threw a lot of juice and a lot of power. That also made lots of heat. As time went on, they started to make hybrids, which was like the TK-44. That had one IO and 3 Vidicons, and it was had some tubes, but it was becoming more solid state. It used to use like 2N422s, TK-722s, good old germanium stuff. And then in the next generation, it got a little smaller, a little lighter, until a company by the name of Philips came out with a what they called a PCP-90, or actually PCP-60, which is first. But that's when they actually put the 3 Plumicons, we were up to Plumicons at that point, into a little box that the guy could put on his shoulder. And he had a backpack with some microwave and stuff, so 1968 Democratic Convention, Floyd, where that camera debuted. I actually have one of them. I showed them to the Long Island Historical Society not too long ago. And then the next real jump, oh, by the way, the cost of those cameras in those days, I mean, you're talking, you know, 120, 130, 140,000 bucks in that money. Today, let's see, we're getting to the first really portable camera, which was kind of made by Ikigami, and there were some others in between. And we start getting down into the camera bodies costing around $70,000, plus the cost of the lens. Today, it's a whole different story. I mean, you've got cameras that weigh 2 pounds, and they produce a high-definition image. With the top of the line, well, let's say, I just saw a Panasonic VeriCam the other day. Excellent camera. 3.5-inch CCDs, they're not 2/3. By the way, they come 1/3, 2/3, and 1/2-inch. No, I'm sorry, that has 2/3-inch CCDs. It makes a beautiful picture. It's made by Panasonic. They used a format called DVD Pro 100 to record it. The basic camera is about $28,000, and that's the real top of the line. It's not a studio camera. A studio camera, a good studio camera, like a Sony studio camera. It looks like a studio camera, not a small camera with a big lens on it. It's talking in that $40,000 to $45,000 range, plus a decent lens which can cost $40,000, $45,000, $50,000. K2RIWK,
2J. Wow, I'm amazed at the price of the lens. I presume some of that is because it's got an extremely large zoom range. Is that what's going on, Eric?
Well, you got to consider the size of the glass. The main aperture lens, that's actually a double convex lens. In the front, most of these lenses, I can't remember exactly what the size is millimeter, but they're about 8 to 12 inches in diameter.
Wow. Is that an F1 lens in order to give it high sensitivity? In which case, you've got to be very careful on how you focus that, isn't that true? Or is the focus automatic?
These are multiple elements. It's actually four stages with a diopter that you can actually drop in the back of it. Actually, it's a ball, not a diopter. It would be like a times two magnifier. The lens itself, they weigh about 30 pounds, but what you're really paying for is you're paying for, an aperture of probably 2.8. If you want to spend more money, you can get it at 2.1, but, you're talking big money for, if you want to do it in T numbers, it's not even a whole stop, so. Plus, there's a lot of sophisticated electronics that go in with it. It's fully remote controllable, zoom and focus. IS control hooked into the camera, the tally light connection. There's usually there's a cadmium CCD, cadmium sulfide cell, rather, to do some automatic light measuring, depends upon which lens for which camera. And you can be rest assured that there are acromats that are very, very hand-selected and hand-corrected for colorimetry and geometry. Very big.
Now, in the old days, those image orthicon cameras, I think, were not very sensitive. I vaguely remember actors and actresses complaining about the fact that when they were on screen, or on stage for a live broadcast, like, say, for instance, the Milton Berle show in 1950, the lights were so bright that you almost got a sunburn off of them. My guess is nowhere near that degree of illumination is required today. Is that true?
You figure the average IO tube, you want anywhere between 175 and 300 foot candles coming back at you. Like the very camera I was looking at the other day, I had to turn the lights off in the room, and I had one little LED and lit the whole room up. You know, you've got cameras now with sensitivities that they go below 1 EV, you know, one light value. You know, sensitivity is also part of the game, and, you know, as with anything else, as you start to go down to where there's less light, there's more gain. Where there's more gain, there's more electron mobility. Where there's more electron mobility, there's more noise, so you pay for it.
If you start getting a noisy picture, you probably also get some delay in the picture and so on. Fascinating stuff. One last question, then. I presume there's a fancy filter stopping your CCD from being infrared sensitive, because when you look at people in infrared, not only do they look strange, but certain kinds of clothing turns transparent, isn't that true?
As you all know about the latest security device on the market, I think you even have something to do with most cameras, and even the IOs and Plumicons, we had a heat absorbing glass, an infrared stop filter. Believe it or not, they've been able to control the sensors. Now they're just starting to go towards CMOS sensors. They're able to more accurately control the bandpath in which the input apertures of the CCDs themselves will pass. So it's come to the point in time where the sensors don't sense any long infrared, and they very ever so slightly sense the short infrared, so it's getting better in that from that perspective. And with the glasses and the optics box, there's enough absorbs in there that you don't no longer need the what we would call a heat absorbing glass.
Sounds like fun. It's kind of amazing that the human eye only covers one octave. From red to blue is approximately one octave, 470 to 890. Wait a minute now. I'm thinking of something else. 700 to 300, I guess it is, nanometers is the optical. It was a 700 to 400 nanometers, approximately, the optical sensing. And so, in theory, there are animals out there, particularly a snake, a pit viper snake, that can see in the infrared. Many insects, like, for instance, wasps and hornets, see very well in the ultraviolet, so they get a very different picture of a flower than we do, and they see things that we don't see. And I've heard stories of people who will get a cataract operation where they'll get a plastic lens inserted for their own lens that failed, and all of a sudden blue things and ultraviolet things start showing up in their eye, and the scene looks very different until they get used to it. Okay, we're off on enough tangents here. When we had a couple of words from Eric, it's always interesting to hear from the broadcaster's point of view what modern equipment is like, wireless equipment. K2KEY, K2IW on the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. It's interesting about what's going on in the broadcasting industry. It's a whole different ballgame from what I'm involved in, what you have been involved in. The first color broadcast I saw, Dick,
was a thing called the CBS color wheel. I'll just say a couple of words on that, and I wonder if you, first, before I go any further, are you familiar with what I'm talking about, over?
The CBS color wheel, very familiar with it, because one of the engineers I worked with used to work for CBS Labs and helped develop that thing, and he had a lot of comments about it. Back to you, Bill.
Yeah, okay, well, I had one here, in fact, working, and the wheel was about 3 feet in diameter. Commercial version, you know, they started producing them commercially for a while there. And it was 3 feet in diameter and then had a cutout, an old fancy bracket to mount it to a 12-inch color TV, not color TV, it's just a 12-inch black and white TV. And I guess to watch a picture, a 12-inch picture with a 36-inch wheel turning in front of it, there wasn't much practicality in that. I think it had two colors of each, two reds, two greens, and two blues, if I'm not mistaken. And then I saw the first commercial produced color TV, which was not the 21AXT22, as Eric just mentioned. This was the one, the 15-inch. They produced a 15-inch tube with the mask and all mounted on the tube. It was, I don't know if it ever went into really how many they ever sold. I think it was known as the CTC, I think two or three. The one with the 21AXT22, that set became CTC5. That became an expensive TV for its day. You know, I don't know how many they sold, but that became the, I guess, the first largely produced color TV. And, of course, those days, you have to have a repair guy visit you quite often, whether to replace tubes or reconverge the miserable thing. I had one here, and they had so many adjustments. They had all these magnetic adjustments up in the corners. You took the front mask, the front frame off, and you had a bunch of, you had adjustments in the corners, and then you had a panel on the bottom there, the convergence panel and everything like that. And it seemed like it was more out of adjustment also. It had terrible high voltage regulation. If you turned up the brightness a little too much, it had a tendency to bloom, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, we came a long way with the cameras and everything, Dick. And I guess that's the last words on it, and then I'll go ahead. If you're interested, we'll continue with the Smith chart, over.
Dick, can you read me? WTWK?
Yes, long story behind the color wheel. Yeah, we do, Eric. Eugene, but Eric, first, tell us a couple words about that color wheel, Eric. From what I was told, at the time, it was the purest color you could get. That was the good news. But because it sequentially sent out red, green, and blue, it gave you quite a bit of flicker until you watched it for a long